He tells them they are out of fuel and about to set up for a planned ditching. Captain Brudnicki orders the TAM's searchlights turned up into the sky so the helicopter can give them a bearing, but Bouchard says he can't see a thing. "Okay, just start heading towards us," the radio dispatcher on the TAM says. "We don't have time. We're going down right now," Bouchard replies. Jim McDougal, handling the radios at the ODC in Suffolk, receives simultaneously the ditching alert and a phone call from Spillane's wife, who wants to know where her husband is. She'd had no idea there was a problem and just happened to call at the wrong moment. McDougal is so panicked by the timing that he hangs up on her. At 9:08, a dispatcher at Coast Guard headquarters in Boston takes a call that an Air National Guard helicopter is going down and scrawls frantically in the incident log, "Helicopter and 130 en route Suffolk. Can't refuel helicopter due visibility. May have to ditch. Stay airborne how long? 20 to 25 minutes. Launch." He then notifies Cape Cod Air Base, where Karen Stimson is chatting with one of her rescue crews. The five airmen get up without a word, file into the bathroom, and then report for duty out on the tarmac. Ruvola finally breaks out of the clouds at 9:28, only 200 feet above the ocean. He goes into a hover and immediately calls for the ditching checklist, which prepares the crew to abandon the aircraft. They've practiced this dozens of times in training, but things are happening so fast that the routines start to fall apart. Jim Mioli has trouble seeing in the dim cabin lighting used with night vision gear, so he can't locate the handle of the 9-man life raft. By the time he finds it, he doesn't have time to put on his Mustang survival suit. Ruvola calls 3 times for Mioli to read him the ditching checklist, but Mioli is too busy to answer him, so Ruvola has to go through it by memory. One of the most important things on the list is for the pilot to reach down and eject his door, but Ruvola is working too hard to remove his hands from the controls. In military terminology, he has become task saturated, and the door stays on. While Ruvola is trying to hold the aircraft in a hover, the PJs scramble to put together the survival gear. Spillane slings a canteen over his shoulder and clips a 1-man life raft to the strap. Jim Mioli, who finally manages to extract the 9-man raft, pushes it to the edge of the jump door and waits for the order to deploy. Rick Smith, draped in survival gear, squats at the edge of the other jump door and looks over the side. Below is an ocean so ravaged by wind that they can't even tell the difference between the waves and the troughs. For all they know, they're jumping 300 feet. As horrible as that is, though, the idea of staying where they are is even worse. The helicopter's going to drop into the ocean at any moment, and no one on the crew wants to be anywhere nearby when it does. Only Dave Ruvola will stay on board. As pilot, it's his job to make sure the aircraft doesn't fall on the rest of his crew. The chances of his escaping with his door still in place are negligible, but that is beside the point. The ditching checklist calls for a certain procedure, a procedure that ensures the survival of the greatest number of crew. That Mioli neglects to put on his survival suit is also in some ways suicidal, but he has no choice. His duty is to oversee a safe bailout, and if he stops to put his survival suit on, the 9-man raft won't be ready for deployment. He jumps without his suit. At 9:30, the number one engine flames out. Spillane can hear the turbine wind down. They've been in a low hover for less than a minute. Ruvola calls out on the intercom, "The number one's out. Bail out. Bail out." The number two is running on fumes. In theory, they should flame out at the same time. This is it. They are going down. Mioli shoves the life raft out the right-hand door and watches it fall, in his words, into the abyss. They are so high up that he doesn't even see it hit the water, and he can't bring himself to jump in after it. Without telling anyone, he decides to take his chances in the helicopter. Ditching protocol calls for co-pilot Bouchard to remain on board as well, but Ruvola orders him out because he decides Bouchard's chances of survival will be higher if he jumps. Bouchard pulls his door release lever, but the door doesn't pop off the fuselage, so he just holds it open with one hand and steps out onto the footboard. He looks back at the radar altimeter, which is fluctuating between 10 feet and 80, and realizes that the timing of his jump will mean the difference between life and death. Ruvola repeats his order to bail out, and Bouchard unplugs the intercom wires from his flight helmet and flips his night vision goggles down. Now he can watch the waves roll underneath him in the dim green light of enhanced vision. He spots a huge crest, takes a breath, and jumps. Spillane, meanwhile, is grabbing some last-minute gear. "I wasn't terrified, I was scared," he says. 40 minutes before, I'd been more scared, thinking about the possibilities. But at the end, I was totally committed. The pilot had made the decision to ditch, and it was a great decision. How many pilots might have just used up the last 20 minutes of fuel trying to hit the drogue? Then you'd fall out of the sky and everyone would die. The helicopter is strangely quiet without the number one engine. The ocean below them, in the words of another pilot, looks like a lunar landscape, cratered and gouged and deformed by wind. Spillane spots Rick Smith at the starboard door, poised to jump, and moves towards him. "I'm convinced he was sizing up the waves," Spillane says. "I wanted desperately to stick together with him. I just had time to sit down, put my arm around his shoulders, and he went. We didn't have time to say anything. You want to say goodbye, you want to do a lot of things, but there's no time for that. Rick went, and a split second later, I did." According to people who've survived long falls, the acceleration of gravity is so heart-stoppingly fast that it's more like getting shot downward out of a cannon. A body accelerates roughly 20 miles an hour for every second it's in the air. After 1 second, it's falling 20 miles an hour. After 2 seconds, 40 miles an hour, and so on, up to 130. At that point, the wind resistance is equal to the force of gravity, and the body is said to have reached terminal velocity. Spillane falls probably 60 or 70 feet, 2.5 seconds of acceleration. He plunges through darkness without any idea where the water is or when he's going to hit. He has a dim memory of letting go of his one-man raft and of his body losing position, and he thinks, "My God, what a long way down." And then everything goes blank. John Spillane has the sort of handsome, regular features that one might expect in a Hollywood actor playing a pararescueman. Playing John Spillane, in fact. His eyes are stone blue without a trace of hardness or indifference. His hair is short and touched with gray. He comes across as friendly, unguarded, and completely sure of himself. He has a quick smile and an offhand way of talking that seems to progress from detail to detail, angle to angle, until there's nothing more to say on a topic. His humor is delivered casually, almost as an afterthought, and seems to surprise even himself. He's of average height, average build, and once ran 40 miles for the hell of it. He seems to be a man who has long since lost the need to prove things to anyone. Spillane grew up in New York City and joined the Air Force at 17. He trained as a combat diver, infiltrating positions, securing beaches, rescuing other combat divers, and then left at 21 to join the Air National Guard. He guard-bummed around the world for a year, returning to Rockaway Beach to lifeguard in the summer, and then signed up for PJ school. After several years of reserve duty, he quit, went through the police academy, and became a scuba diver for the New York City Police Department. For 3 years, he pulled bodies out of submerged cars and mucked guns out of the East River, and finally decided to go back to school before his GI Bill ran out. He started out majoring in geology. I wanted to go stomp mountaintops for a while, but he fell in love instead and ended up moving out to Suffolk to work full-time for the Guard. That was in 1989. He was 32, one of the most widely experienced PJs in the country. When John Spillane hits the Atlantic Ocean, he's going about 50 miles an hour. Water's the only element that offers more resistance the harder you hit it, and at 50 miles an hour, it might as well be concrete. Spillane fractures 3 bones in his right arm, 1 bone in his left leg, 4 ribs in his chest, ruptures a kidney, and bruises his pancreas. The flippers, the one-man raft, and the canteen are all torn off his body. Only the mask, which he wore backward with the strap in his mouth, stays on as it's supposed to. Spillane doesn't remember the moment of impact, and he doesn't remember the moment he first realized he was in the water. His memory goes from falling to swimming, with nothing in between. When he understands that he's swimming, that's all he understands. He doesn't know who he is, why he's there, or how he got there. He has no history and no future. He's just a consciousness at night in the middle of the sea. When Spillane treats injured seamen offshore, one of the first things he evaluates is their degree of consciousness. The highest level, known as alert and oriented times 4, describes almost everyone in an everyday situation. They know who they are, where they are, what time it is, and what's just happened. If someone suffers a blow to the head, the first thing they lose is recent events, alert and oriented times 3. And the last thing they lose is their identity. A person who has lost all 4 levels of consciousness, right down to their identity, is said to be alert and oriented times 0. When John Spillane wakes up in the water, he is alert and oriented times 0. His understanding of the world is reduced to the fact that he exists, nothing more. Almost simultaneously, he understands that he's in excruciating pain. For a long time, that is all he knows, until he sees the life raft. Spillane may be alert and oriented times 0, but he knows to swim for a life raft when he sees one. It's been pushed out by Jim Mioli, the flight engineer, and has inflated automatically when it hits the water. Now it is scudding along on the wave crests, the sea anchors barely holding it down in the 70-knot wind. I lined up on it, intercepted it, and hung off the side, says Spillane. I knew I was in the ocean, in a desperate situation, and I was hurt. I didn't know anything else. It was while I was hanging onto the raft that it all started coming back to me. We were on a mission. We ran out of fuel. I bailed out. I'm not alone. While Spillane is hanging off the raft, a gust of wind catches it and flips it over. One moment, Spillane is in the water trying to figure out who he is. The next moment, he's high and dry. Instantly, he feels better. He's lying on the wobbly nylon floor, evaluating the stabbing pain in his chest. He thinks he's punctured his lungs. When he hears people shouting in the distance, he kneels and points his diver's light in their direction, and just as he's wondering how to help them, whoever they are, the storm gods flip the raft over again. Spillane is dumped back into the sea. He clings to the safety line, gasping and throwing up seawater, and almost immediately the wind flips the raft over a third time. He's now gone 1.5 revolutions. Spillane is back inside, lying spread-eagle on the floor, when the raft is flipped a 4th and final time. Spillane is tossed back into the water, this time clinging to a rubberized nylon bag that later turns out to contain 6 wool blankets. It floats, and Spillane hangs off it and watches the raft go cartwheeling off across the wave crests. He's left alone and dying on the sea. After I lost contact with the raft, I was by myself, and I realized my only chance of survival was to make it until the storm subsided, he says. There was no way they could pick us up. I'd just ditched a perfectly good helicopter, and I knew our guys would be the ones to come out and get us if they could. But they couldn't. They couldn't refuel. So I'm contemplating this, and I know I cannot make it through the storm. They might have somebody on scene when light breaks, but I'm not going to make it that long. I'm dying inside. For the first time since the ordeal began, Spillane has the time to contemplate his own death. He isn't panicked so much as saddened by the idea. His wife is 5 months pregnant with their first child, and he's been home very little recently. He was in paramedic school and in training for the New York City Marathon. He wishes that he'd spent more time at home. He wishes, incredibly, that he'd cut the grass one more time before winter. He wishes there was someone who could tell his wife and family what happened in the end. It bothers him that Dave Ruvola probably died taking the helicopter in. It bothers him they're all going to die for lack of 500 pounds of jet fuel. The shame of it all, he thinks. We have this $8 million helicopter. Nothing's wrong with it. Nobody's shooting at us. We're just out of fuel. Spillane has regained his full senses by this point, and the circumstances he finds himself in are nightmarish beyond words. It's so dark that he can't see his hand in front of his face. The waves just rumble down on him out of nowhere and bury him for a minute at a time. The wind is so strong, it doesn't blow the water so much as fling it. There's no way to keep it out of his stomach. Every few minutes, he has to retch it back up. Spillane has lost his one-man life raft. His ribs are broken, and every breath feels like he's being run through with a hot fire poker. He's crying out in pain, and dawn isn't for another 8 hours. After an hour of making his farewells and trying to keep the water out of his stomach, Spillane spots two strobes in the distance. The Mustang suits all have strobe lights on them, and it's the first real evidence he has that someone else has survived the ditching. Spillane's immediate reaction is to swim toward them, but he stops himself. There's no way he's going to live out the night, he knows. So he might as well just die on his own. That way he won't inflict his suffering on anyone else. I didn't want them to see me go, he says. I didn't want them to see me in pain. It's the same with marathons. Don't talk to me. Let me just suffer through this by myself. What finally drove me to them was survival training. It emphasizes strength in numbers. And I know that if I'm with them, I'll try harder not to die. But I couldn't let them see me in pain, I told myself. I couldn't let them down. Believing that their chances will be slightly less negligible in a group, Spillane slowly makes his way toward the lights. He's buoyed up by his life vest and wetsuit and swimming with his broken arm stretched out in front of him, gripping the blanket bag. It takes a long time, and the effort exhausts him, but he can see the lights slowly getting closer. They disappear in the wave troughs, appear on the crests, and then disappear again. Finally, after a couple of hours of swimming, he gets close enough to shout and then to make out their faces. It's Dave Ruvola and Jim Mioli, roped together with parachute cord. Ruvola seems fine, but Mioli is nearly incoherent with hypothermia. He only has his Nomex flight suit on, and the chances of him lasting until dawn are even lower than Spillane's. Ruvola had escaped the helicopter unscathed, but barely. He knew that the rotors would tear him and the helicopter apart if they hit the water at full speed. So he moved the aircraft away from his men, waited for the number two engine to flame out, and then performed what's known as a hovering auto-rotation. As the helicopter fell, its dead rotors started to spin, and Ruvola used that energy to slow the aircraft down. Like downshifting a car on a hill, a hovering auto-rotation is a way of dissipating the force of gravity by feeding it back through the engine. By the time the helicopter hit the water, it had slowed to a manageable speed, and all the torque had been bled out of the rotors. They just smacked the face of an oncoming wave and stopped. Ruvola found himself in a classic training situation, only it was real life. He had to escape from a flooded helicopter upside down in complete darkness. He was a former PJ, though, and a marathon swimmer, so being underwater was something he was used to. The first thing he did was reach for his Heeds bottle, a 3-minute air supply strapped to his left leg, but it had been ripped loose during the ditching. All he had was the air in his lungs. He reached up, pulled the quick release on his safety belt, and it was then that he realized he'd never kicked the exit door out. He was supposed to do that so it wouldn't get jammed shut on impact, trapping him inside. He found the door handle, turned it, and pushed. To his amazement, the door fell open. Ruvola kicked his way out from under the fuselage, tripped the CO2 cartridge on his life vest, and shot 10 or 15 feet to the surface. He popped up into a world of shrieking darkness and landsliding seas. At one point, the crest of a wave drove him so far under the surface that the pressure change damaged his inner ear. Ruvola started yelling for the other crew members, and a few minutes later, flight engineer Mioli, who'd also managed to escape the sinking helicopter, answered him in the darkness. They started swimming toward each other, and after 5 or 10 minutes, Ruvola got close enough to grab Mioli by his survival vest. He took the hood off his survival suit, put it on Mioli's head, and then tied their two bodies together with parachute cord. They've been in the water for a couple of hours when Spillane finally struggles up, face locked up with pain. The first thing Ruvola sees is a glint of light on a face mask, and he thinks that maybe it's a Navy SEAL who has airlocked out of a U.S. submarine and is coming to save them. It isn't. Spillane swims up, grabs a strap on Ruvola's flotation vest, and clamps his other arm around the blanket bag. "What's that?" Ruvola screams. "I don't know. I'll open it tomorrow," Spillane yells back. "Open it now," Ruvola answers. Spillane is in too much pain to argue about it, so he opens the bag and watches several dark shapes, the blankets, go snapping off downwind. He tosses the bag aside and settles down to face the next few hours as best he can. One can tell by the very handwriting in the District 1 incident log that the dispatcher, in this case a Coast Guardsman named Gill, can't quite believe what he's writing down. The words are large and sloppy and salted with exclamation points. At one point he jots down, apropos of nothing, "They're not alone out there," as if to reassure himself that things will turn out all right. That entry comes at 9:30, seconds after Bouchard calls in the first engine loss. 5 minutes later, Gill writes down, 3951 North, 720 West, ditching here, 5 people on board. 7 minutes after that, the tanker plane, which will circle the area until their fuel runs low, reports hearing an EPIRB signal for 15 seconds, then nothing. From Gill's notes, 9:30, Tamaroa in area, launched H-65. 9:48, Cape Cod 60. 9:53, Commander of Atlantic Area briefed. "Anything you want. Navy ship would be great. We'll look." Within minutes of the ditching, rescue assets from Florida to Massachusetts are being readied for deployment. The response is massive and nearly instantaneous. At 9:48, 13 minutes into it, Air Station Cape Cod launches a Falcon jet and an H-3 helicopter. Half an hour later, a Navy P-3 jet at Brunswick Naval Air Station is requested and readied. The P-3 is infrared equipped to detect heat-emitting objects like people. The Tamaroa has diverted before the helicopter has even gone down. At 10:23, Boston requests a second Coast Guard cutter, the Spencer. They even consider diverting an aircraft carrier. The survivors are drifting fast in mountainous seas, and the chances of spotting them are terrible. Helicopters will have minimal time on scene because they can't refuel. It's unlikely conditions would permit a hoist rescue anyway, and there's no way to determine if the guardsmen's radios are even working. That leaves the Tamaroa to do the job, but she wasn't even able to save the Satori crew during less severe conditions. The storm is barreling westward, straight toward the ditch point, and wave heights are climbing past anything ever recorded in the area. If things look bad for Ruvola's crew, they don't look much better for the people trying to rescue them. It's not inconceivable that another helicopter will have to ditch during the rescue effort, or that a Coast Guardsman will get washed off the Tamaroa. For that matter, the Tamaroa herself, at 205 feet, is not necessarily immune to disaster. One freak wave could roll her over and put 80 men in the water. Half a dozen aircraft, two ships, and 200 rescuers are heading for 39 North, 72 West. The more men out there, the higher the chances are of someone else getting into trouble. A succession of disasters could draw the rescue assets of the entire east coast of the United States out to sea. A Falcon jet out of Air Station Cape Cod is the first aircraft on scene. It arrives 90 minutes after the ditching, and the pilot sets up what is known as an expanding square search. He moves slightly down sea of the last known position, the splash point, and starts flying ever-increasing squares until he's covered an area 10 miles across. He flies at 200 feet, just below cloud cover, and estimates the probability of spotting the survivors to be 1 in 3. He turns up nothing. Around 11:30, he expands his search to a 20-mile square and starts all over again, slowly working his way southwest with the direction of drift. The infrared-equipped P-3 is getting ready to launch from Brunswick, and a Coast Guard helicopter is pounding its way southward from Cape Cod. And then, 10 minutes into the second square, he picks up something, a weak signal on 243 megahertz. That's a frequency coded into Air National Guard radios. It means at least one of the airmen is still alive. The Falcon pilot homes in on the signal and tracks it to a position about 20 miles down sea of the splash point. Whoever it is, they're drifting fast. The pilot comes in low, scanning the sea with night vision goggles, and finally spots a lone strobe flashing below them in the darkness. It's appearing and disappearing behind the huge swell. Moments later, he spots three more strobes half a mile away. All but one of the crew are accounted for. The pilot circles, flashing his lights, and then radios his position in to District 1. An H-3 helicopter equipped with a hoist and rescue swimmer is only 20 minutes away. The whole ordeal could be over in less than an hour. The Falcon circles the strobes until the H-3 arrives, and then heads back to base with a rapidly falling fuel gauge. The H-3 is a huge machine, similar to the combat helicopters used in Vietnam, and has spare fuel tanks installed inside the cabin. It can't refuel in mid-flight, but it can stay airborne for 4 or 5 hours. The pilot, Ed DeWitt, tries to establish a 40-foot hover, but wind shear keeps spiking him downward. The ocean is a ragged white expanse in his searchlights, and there are no visual reference points to work off of. At one point, he turns downwind and almost gets driven into the sea. DeWitt edges his helicopter to within 100 yards of the three men and tells his flight engineer to drop the rescue basket. There's no way he's putting his swimmer in the water, but these are experienced rescue men, and they may be able to extract themselves. It's either that or wait for the storm to calm down. The flight engineer pays out the cable and watches in alarm as the basket is blown straight back toward the tail rotors. It finally reaches the water, swept backward at an angle of 45 degrees, and DeWitt tries to hold a steady hover long enough for the swimmers to reach the basket. He tries for almost an hour, but the waves are so huge that the basket doesn't spend more than a few seconds on each crest before dropping to the end of its cable. Even if the men could get themselves into the basket, a shear pin in the hoist mechanism is designed to fail with loads over 600 pounds, and three men in waterlogged clothing would definitely push that limit. The entire assembly, cable, basket, everything, would let go into the sea. DeWitt finally gives up trying to save the airmen and goes back up to a hover at 200 feet. In the distance, he can see the Tamaroa, searchlights pointed straight up, plunging through the storm. He vectors her in toward the position of the lone strobe in the distance, Graham Bouchon, and then drops a flare by the others and starts back for Suffolk. He's only minutes away from Bingo, the point at which an aircraft doesn't have enough fuel to make it back to shore. 200 feet below, John Spillane watches his last hope clatter away toward the north. He hadn't expected to get rescued, but still, it's hard to watch. The only benefit he can see is that his family will know for sure that he died. That might spare them weeks of false hope. In the distance, Spillane can see lights rising and falling in the darkness. He assumes it's a Falcon jet looking for the other airmen, but its lights are moving strangely. It's not moving like an aircraft. It's moving like a ship. The Tamaroa has taken 4 hours to cover the 15 miles to the splash point. Her screws are turning for 12 knots and making 3. Commander Brudnicki doesn't know how strong the wind is, because it rips the anemometer off the mast. But pilot Ed DeWitt reports that his airspeed indicator hit 87 knots, 100 miles an hour, while he was in a stationary hover. The Tamaroa's course to the downed airmen puts them in a beam sea, which starts to roll the ship through an arc of 110 degrees. At that angle, bulkheads are easier to walk on than floors. In the wheelhouse, Commander Brudnicki is surprised to find himself looking up at the crest of the waves. And when he orders full rudder and full bell, it takes 30 or 40 seconds to see any effect at all. Later, after stepping off the ship, he says, "I certainly hope that was the high point of my career." The first airman they spot is Graham Bouchon, swimming alone and relatively unencumbered, a half mile from the other three. He's in a Mustang survival suit and has a pen gun flare and the only functional radio beacon of the entire crew. Brudnicki orders the operations officer, Lieutenant Christopher Furtney, to maneuver the Tamaroa upsea of Bouchon and then drift down on him. Large objects drift faster than small ones, and if the ship is upwind of Bouchon, the waves won't smash him against the hull. The gunner's mate starts firing flares off from cannons on the flying bridge, and a detail of seamen crouch in the bow with throwing ropes, waiting for their chance. They can hardly keep their feet in the wind. The engines come to a full stop, and the Tamaroa wallows beam to in the huge seas. It's a dangerous position to be in. The Tamaroa loses her righting arm at 72 degrees, and she's already heeling to 55. Drifting down on swimmers is standard rescue procedure, but the seas are so violent that Bouchon keeps getting flung out of reach. There are times when he's 30 feet higher than the men trying to rescue him. The crew in the bow can't get a throwing rope anywhere near him, and Brudnicki won't order his rescue swimmer overboard because he's afraid he won't get him back. The men on deck finally realize that if the boat's not going to Bushore, Bushore's going to have to go to it. Swim, they scream over the rail. Swim! Bushore rips off his gloves and hood and starts swimming for his life. He swims as hard as he can. He swims until his arms give out. He claws his way up to the ship, gets swept around the bow, struggles back within reach of it again, and finally catches hold of a cargo net that the crew have dropped over the side. The net looks like a huge rope ladder and is held by 6 or 7 men at the rail. Bushore twists his hands into the mesh and slowly gets hauled up the hull. One good wave at the wrong moment could take them all out. The deck crewmen land Bushore like a big fish and carry him into the deckhouse. He's dry-heaving seawater and can barely stand. His core temperature has dropped to 94 degrees. He's been in the water 4 hours and 25 minutes. Another few hours and he may not have been able to cling to the net. It's taken half an hour to get one man on board, and they have 4 more to go, one of whom hasn't even been sighted yet. It's not looking good. Brudnicki is also starting to have misgivings about putting his men on deck. The larger waves are sweeping the bow and completely burying the crew. They keep having to do head counts to make sure no one has been swept overboard. It was the hardest decision I've ever had to make, to put my people out there and rescue that crew, Brudnicki says, because I knew there was a chance I could lose some of my men. If I'd decided not to do the rescue, no one back home would have said a thing. They knew it was almost impossible. But can you really make a conscious decision to say, I'm just going to watch those people in the water die? Brudnicki decides to continue the rescue. 20 minutes later, he has the Tamaroa in a beam sea 100 yards upwind of the 3 guardsmen. Crew members are lighting off flares and aiming searchlights, and the chief quartermaster is on the flying bridge radioing Fertney when to fire the ship's engine. Not only do they have to maneuver the drift, but they have to time the roll of the ship so the gunwale rides down toward the waterline while the men in the water grab for the net. As it is, the gunwales are riding from water level to 20 feet in the air virtually every wave. Spillane is injured, Mioli's incoherent, and Ruvola is helping to support them both. There's no way they'll be able to swim like Bushore. Spillane watches the ship heaving through the breaking seas, and for the life of him can't imagine how they're going to do this. As far as he's concerned, a perfectly likely outcome is for all 3 of them to drown within sight of the ship because a pickup's impossible. My muscles were getting rigid. I was in great pain, he says. The Tam pulled up in front of us and turned broadside to the waves, and I couldn't believe they did that. They were putting themselves in terrible risk. We could hear them all screaming on the deck, and we could see the chemical lights coming at us, tied to the ends of the ropes. The ropes are difficult to catch, so the deck crew throw the cargo net over the side. Lieutenant Fertney again tries to ease his ship over to the swimmers, but the vessel is 1,600 tons and almost impossible to control. Finally, on the 3rd attempt, they snag the net. Their muscles are cramping with cold, and Jim Mioli is about to start a final slide into hypothermia. The men on deck give a terrific heave. They're pulling up 600 pounds dead weight. And at the same time, a large wave drops out from underneath the swimmers. They're exhausted and desperate, and the net is wrenched out of their hands. The next thing Spillane knows, he's underwater. He fights his way to the surface just as the boat rolls inward toward them, and he grabs the net again. This is it. If he can't do it now, he dies. The deck crew heaves again, and Spillane feels himself getting pulled up the steel hull. He climbs up a little higher, feels hands grabbing him, and the next thing he knows, he's being pulled over the gunwale onto the deck. He's in such pain he cannot stand. The men pin him against the bulkhead, cut off his survival suit, and then carry him inside, staggering with the roll of the ship. Spillane can't see Rivola and Mioli. They haven't managed to get back onto the net. The waves wash the two men down the hull toward the ship's stern, where the 12-foot screw is digging out a cauldron of boiling water. Furtney shuts the engines down, and the two men get carried around the stern and then up the port side of the ship. Rivola catches the net for the second time and gets one hand into the mesh. He clamps the other one around Mioli and screams into his face, "You got to do this, Jim! There aren't too many second chances in life. This is going to take everything you got." Mioli nods and wraps his hands into the mesh. Rivola gets a foothold as well as a handhold and grips with all the strength in his cramping muscles. The two men get dragged upward, penduluming in and out with the roll of the ship until the deck crew at the rail can reach them. They grab Rivola and Mioli by the hair, the Mustang suit, the combat vest, anything they can get their hands on, and pull them over the steel rail. Like Spillane, they're retching seawater and can barely stand. Jim Mioli has been in 60-degree water for over 5 hours and is severely hypothermic. His core temperature is 90.4, 8 degrees below normal. Another couple of hours and he'd be dead. The two airmen are carried inside. Their clothing is cut off, and they're laid in bunks. Spillane is taken to the executive officer's quarters and given an IV and catheter and examined by the ship's paramedic. His blood pressure is 140 over 90, his pulse is 100, and he's running a slight fever. Eyes pearled, abdomen and chest tenderness, pain to quadricep. The paramedic radios SAROPS. Search and Rescue Operations, Boston. Fractured wrist, possibly ribs, suspect internal injury. Taking Tylenol 3 and seasick patch. Boston relays the information to an Air National Guard flight surgeon, who says he's worried about internal bleeding and tells them to watch the abdomen carefully. If it gets more and more tender to the touch, he's bleeding inside and has to be evacuated by helicopter. Spillane thinks about dangling in a rescue litter over the ocean and says he'd rather not. At daybreak, the executive officer comes in to shave and change his clothes, and Spillane apologizes for bleeding and vomiting all over his bed. "Hey, whatever it takes," the officer says. He opens the portal hatch, and Spillane looks out at the howling gray sky and the ravaged ocean. "Ah, could you close that?" he says. "I can't take it." The crew, unshaven and exhausted after 36 hours on deck, are staggering around the ship like drunks. And the mission's far from over. Rick Smith is still out there. He's one of the most highly trained pararescue jumpers in the country, and there's no question in anyone's mind that he's alive. They just have to find him. PJ, wearing black 1/4-inch wetsuit, went outdoor with one-man life raft and spray sheet, 2 12-ounce cans of water, mirror, flare kit, granola bar, and whistle, the Coast Guard dispatcher in Boston records. Man is in great shape, can last quite a while, 5 to 7 days. A total of 9 aircraft are slated for the search, including an E-2 surveillance plane to coordinate the air traffic on scene. Jim Doherty, a PJ who went through training with Smith and Spillane, throws a tin of Skoal chewing tobacco in his gear to give Smith when they find him. "This guy's so good," guardsmen are saying, "he's just going to come through the front door at Suffolk Air Base wondering where the hell we all were. The dreams of the dead. All collapsed, and the great shroud of the sea rolled on as it had 5,000 years ago. Herman Melville, Moby Dick. By the time word has spread throughout Gloucester that the fleet's in trouble, the storm has retrograded to within 350 miles of Cape Cod and developed such a steep pressure gradient that an eye starts to form. Satellite photos show a cyclonic swirl 2,000 miles wide off the east coast. The southern edge reaches Jamaica, and the northern edge reaches the coast of Labrador. In all, 750,000 square miles of ocean are experiencing gale force conditions, and an area 3 or 4 times that is indirectly involved in the storm. On the satellite photos, moist air flowing into the low looks like a swirl of cream in a cup of black coffee. Thick strands of white cloud cover and dark Arctic air circle 1.5 times around the low before making it into the center. The low grinds steadily toward the coast, intensifying as it goes, and by the morning of October 31st, it has stalled 200 miles south of Montauk, Long Island. The worst winds, in the northeast quadrant, are getting dragged straight across Gloucester Harbor and Massachusetts Bay. So sudden and violent are the storm's first caresses of the coast that a tinge of hysteria creeps into the local weather bulletins. Unconfirmed reports of 2 houses collapsing have been received from the Gloucester area. Other Massachusetts locations under the gun. Seas of 25 to 45 feet have occurred today from Georges Bank east. The dangerous storm associated with high seas is moving southeast, closer to New England. The first coastal flood warnings are issued at 3:15 a.m. on the 29th, based mainly on reports from Nantucket of sustained winds up to 45 knots. Predictions from the Weather Service's computers are systematically exceeding almost all atmospheric models for the area, and high tides are predicted to be 2 to 3 feet above normal. These predictions, as it turns out, will be way too low. The warnings go out via satellite uplink along something called the NOAA Weather Wire, which feeds into local media and emergency services. By dawn, radio and television announcers are informing the public about the oncoming storm, and the State Emergency Management Agency is contacting local authorities along the coast to make sure they take precautions. The EMA is based in Framingham, Massachusetts, outside of Boston, and has direct lines to Governor Weld's office, the National Guard, the State Police Barracks, and the National Weather Service. Any threat to the public health is routed through the EMA. If local communities don't have the resources to cope, state agencies step in. If state agencies can't handle it, the federal government gets called. The EMA is set up to handle everything from severe thunderstorms to nuclear war. October 31st, onshore, is deceptively calm and mild. Oak leaves skitter down the street, and the midday sun has a thin warmth to it that people won't feel again until spring. The only sign that something is amiss is along the coast, where huge gray swells start to roll in that can be heard miles inland. Swells are the outriders of sea weather, and if they keep getting bigger, the weather's approaching. The Gloucester Police Department blocks access to the shore, but people go anyway, parking their cars 0.5 mile away and walking through the rising wind and rain to hilltops where they can look out to sea. They're greeted by an ocean that has been wholly transformed. Swells march shoreward from the horizon in great even bands, their white crests streaming sideways in the wind, and their ranks breaking, reforming, and breaking again as they close in on Cape Ann. In the shallows, they draw themselves up, hesitate, and then implode against the rocks with a force that seems to shake the entire peninsula. Air trapped inside their gray barrels gets blown out the back walls in geysers higher than the waves themselves. 30-foot seas are rolling in from the North Atlantic and attacking the town of Gloucester with a cold, heavy rage. By mid-afternoon, the wind is hitting hurricane force, and people are having a hard time walking, standing up, being heard. Moans emanate from the electric lines that only offshore fishermen have ever heard before. Waves inundate Good Harbor Beach and the parking lot in front of the Stop and Shop. They rip up entire sections of Atlantic Road. They deposit a 15-foot-high tangle of lobster traps and sea muck at the end of Grapevine Road. They fill the swimming pool of a backshore mansion with ocean-bottom rubble. They suck beach cobbles up their huge faces and sling them inland, smashing windows, peppering lawns. They overrun the seawall at Brace Cove, spill into Niles Pond, and continue into the woods beyond. For a brief while, it's possible to surf across people's lawns. So much salt water gets pumped into Niles Pond that it overflows and cuts Eastern Point in half. Eastern Point is where the rich live, and by nightfall the ocean is 2 feet deep in some of the nicest living rooms in the state. In several places around the state, houses float off their foundations and out to sea. Waves break through a 30-foot sand dune at Ballston Beach in Truro and flood the headwaters of the Pamet River. 6,000-pound boat moorings drag inside Chatham Harbor. The Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant in New Hampshire shuts down because seaweed clogs the condenser intakes. A Delta Airlines pilot at Logan is surprised to see spray from breaking waves top the 200-foot cranes on Deer Island. Just sitting on the runway, his airspeed indicator clocks 80 miles an hour. Houses are washed out to sea in Gloucester, Swampscott, and on Cape Cod. Rising waters inundate half of the town of Nantucket. A man is swept off the rocks in Point Judith, Rhode Island, and is never seen again. And a surfer dies trying to ride 20-foot shore break in Massachusetts. Plum Island is cut in half by the waves, as is Hawk's Neck and Squantum in Quincy. Over 100 houses are destroyed in the town of Scituate, and the National Guard has to be called out to help the inhabitants evacuate. One elderly woman is taken from her house by a backhoe while surf breaks down her front door. The winds have set so much water in motion that the ocean gets piled up against the continent and starts blocking the rivers. The Hudson backs up 100 miles to Albany and causes flooding, and the Potomac does the same. Tides are 5 feet above normal in Boston Harbor, within 1 inch of an all-time Boston record. Had the storm occurred a week earlier, during the highest tides of the month, water levels would be a foot and a half higher, flooding downtown Boston. Storm surge and huge seas extinguish Isle of Shoals and Boone's Island lighthouses off the coast of Maine. Some Democrats are cheered to see waves obliterate the front of President Bush's summer mansion in Kennebunkport. Damage along the East Coast surpasses $1.5 billion, including millions of dollars in lobster pots and other fixed fishing gear. The only light I can shed on the severity of the storm is that until then we had never, ever, had a lobster trap move offshore, says Bob Brown. Some were moved 13 miles to the west. It was the worst storm I have ever heard of or experienced. By nightfall on the 31st, with wave heights at their peak and the east coast bearing the full brunt of the storm, the Coast Guard finds itself with two major search and rescue operations on its hands. In Boston, a Coast Guardsman starts telephoning every harbor master in New England, asking if the Andrea Gale is in port. If the town is too small to have a harbor master, they ask a town selectman to walk down to the waterfront and take a look. Coast Guard cutters also poke their way along the coast, checking every harbor and cove they can find. In Maine's Jonesport area, a cutter checks Sawyer's Cove, Rock Harbor, Black Cove, Moose Peak Light, Chandler and Englishman Bay, Little Machias Bay, Machias Bay East Side, Machias Bay West Side, and Mistaken Harbor, all without success. The entire coast from Lubeck, Maine, to eastern Long Island is scrutinized without turning up any sign of the Andrea Gale. The search for Rick Smith is in some ways simpler than for the Andrea Gale, because the pilots know exactly where he went down. But a single human being, even with a strobe light, is extremely hard to spot in such conditions. One pilot missed a 500-foot freighter because it was obscured by waves during one leg of his search. As a result, the combined assets of half a dozen East Coast air bases are thrown into the search. Smith has a wife and three daughters at home, and he knows personally a significant proportion of the people who are looking for him. He's one of the most highly trained survival swimmers in the world, and if he hits the water alive, he'll probably stay that way. He might eventually die of thirst, but he's not going to drown. The first thing the Coast Guard does is drop a radio marker buoy where the other guardsmen were picked up. The buoy drifts the way a person would, and the search area shifts continuously southwestward. Planes fly 30-mile track line searches 500 feet above the water, but in these conditions, the chances of spotting a man are only 1 in 3, so some areas get flown over and over again. There are so many planes in the air, and the search area is so limited, that it's a virtual certainty they'll find him. And indeed, they find almost everything. They find the 9-man life raft pushed out of the helicopter by Jim Mioli. A guard diver is dropped from a helicopter to knife it so it won't throw off other searchers. They find the Avon raft abandoned by the Tamaroa, and rafts from other boats they didn't even know about. And then, just before dusk on the 31st, a Coast Guard plane spots a stain of day-glow green dye in the water. PJs are known to carry dye for just such emergencies, and this undoubtedly comes from Rick Smith. The pilot circles lower and sees a dark shape at the center, probably Rick Smith himself. The search plane crew drop a marker buoy, life raft, and flare kit, and the pilot radios the coordinates into Boston. A helicopter is diverted to the scene, and the cutter Tamaroa, 2.5 hours away, changes course and starts heading for the spot. An H-60 launches from Elizabeth City, escorted by a tanker plane, and a Navy jet equipped with forward-looking infrared is readied for takeoff. If the rescuers can't get Smith by helicopter, they'll get him by ship. If they can't get him by ship, they'll drop a life raft. If he's too weak to get into the life raft, they'll drop a rescue swimmer. Smith is one of their own, and they're going to get him one way or another. It's full dark when the first helicopter, zeroed in by the marker buoy, arrives on scene. There's no sign of Smith. The Coast Guard pilot who spotted him, debriefed back on base, says the dye was fresh, and he was awful sure there was a man in the middle of it. The seas were too rough to tell whether he swam to the life raft that was dropped to him, though. 3 hours later, one of the helicopter pilots radios that they've spotted Smith near the radio marker buoy. Another H-60 and tanker plane prepare to launch from Suffolk, but no sooner are those orders given than the pilot on scene corrects himself. He didn't spot a person, he spotted a life raft. It was probably dropped by the Coast Guard earlier that day. The Suffolk aircraft stand down. Throughout that night, the storm slides south along the coast and then doubles back on itself, heading toward Nova Scotia and dissipating by the hour. The convective engine of the storm that sucks warm, moist air off the ocean is finally starting to break down in cold northern water. By the morning of November 1st, the conditions are stable enough to evacuate John Spillane, and he strapped into a rescue litter and carried out of his room and onto the aft deck of the Tamaroa. He's hoisted up into the belly of an H-3 and flown to Atlantic City, where he's rushed into intensive care and given 2 units of blood. A few hours later, a Coast Guardsman tracks down a search pilot who says that he dropped green dye into the water to mark a line he'd seen. That explains the dye, but not the person spotted at the center of it. A Coast Guard survival specialist named Mike Hyde says that Smith could stay warm virtually forever in a quarter-inch wetsuit, but that he might drown by inhaling water into his lungs. There aren't any charts or graphs for survival time in the conditions he was in, Hyde says. If Smith made it through the storm, though, Hyde's personal guess is that he could survive another 4 days. Eventually, he'll die of dehydration. The sea is much calmer now, but the search has been going full bore for 72 hours without turning up anything. Chances are almost non-existent that Smith is alive. On the morning of November 2nd, the storm now over Prince Edward Island and failing fast, the cutter Tamaroa makes port at Shinnecock Inlet, Long Island, and Ruvola, Bouchard, and Mioli are taken off by motor launch. Rick Smith's wife, Marianne, is at Suffolk Air Base for the event, and several people express concern over her watching the airmen reunited with their families. "What do they think? That I want those women to lose their husbands, too?" she wonders. She takes John Brame, the PJ supervisor, aside and says, "Look, John, if they haven't found Rick by now, they're not going to. As far as I'm concerned, I'm a widow, and I need to know what's going to happen." Brame expresses the hope that they might still find him, but Marianne just shakes her head. "If he were alive, he'd signal," she says. "He's not alive." Marianne Smith, who's nursing a 3-week-old baby, practically hasn't slept since the ditching. She found out about it late the first night when someone from the airbase called and woke her up out of an exhausted sleep. It took her a minute to even understand what the person was saying, and when she did, he reassured her that it was a controlled ditching and everything would be fine. Things were not fine, though. First, they wouldn't tell her which 4 crew members had been picked up by the Tamaroa. She understandably assumed one of